Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Well, it's that time of year when sometimes, you know, we feel like escaping, going to do something a little different, something maybe like a road trip. And later in today's show, you'll hear from someone who travels the world in search of interesting stories. She's Kitson Jasinka, and she writes for National Geographic Kids. And today we're going to talk about her latest book for National Geographic Kids, which is 125 Wacky Roadside Attractions. But don't think this is just for kids, because there are many, many, many places in that book that I would go with or without kids. It's a really neat book. First, with today's global economy, many businesses are struggling to compete and stay afloat, and that's especially true for new businesses. One of the biggest challenges managers face today, and small business owners, senior executives alike, is strategy. And I'm not talking about developing strategy, but executing against that strategy. And there are a number of reasons for that. In a few minutes, we'll hear from Paul Leinwand, who, together with the co-author of Strategy That Works, has developed 5 unconventional acts that bridge the gap between strategy and execution. That comes up in about 2 minutes. Again, really good book. Please stay tuned. And I'll introduce my guest when we return. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. We'll be right back.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Coming July 25th on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, the whole detox with Dr. Deanna Minich. She says it's not enough to just detox the body. You have to detox every area of your life for complete holistic health. This 21-day program will help you do that. We'll also hear from Dr. Craig Malkin, whose book, Rethinking Narcissism, helps you recognize and get rid of the narcissists who've infiltrated your life. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific time here on Alternative Talk 1150 and find more than 400 podcasts at conversationslive.net.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to best practitioner Dr. Nels Rasmussen, we cover the world of animals. This week, July 17th, we'll start with the incredible Dr. Pohl story and my resulting concern for Dr. Jeff. Then, one of the best talkers and storytellers I've ever had on the air, Janice, president of Nuke Pro Supplements, joins us. We'll learn all about their wonderful products and introduce their latest cancer-fighting supplement. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Did you know that capsizing boats and people falling overboard account for over 70% of boating fatalities? 80% of those fatalities occur on boats under 26 feet and on boats with operators who've had no formal boating instruction. 50% of all boating accidents involve alcohol. Be smart this summer. Know who you're boating with. Wear a Coast Guard approved life jacket and don't drink and boat. This message is brought to you by supporters of Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair and the JMB Group, who wish you safe boating fun.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to brighten your day.
Talk radio for the heart and soul. Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And I actually sat down with my next guest. I sat down with him last week, and we had a conversation about his new book, Strategy That Works. Let me tell you a little bit about him. And we're going to bring that conversation to you in just a moment. He is a thought leader on strategy growth and capability building for PwC's strategy consulting group, which is called Strategy Plus. His name is Paul Leinwan, and he is a principal of the firm. He advises clients on what we might expect, strategy growth, capability building, a focus on consumer product and retail sectors. And he's co-authored two books, The Essential Advantage, How to Win with a Capabilities-Driven Strategy, which was published by Harvard Business Press Review Press, and Cut Costs and Grow Stronger, again, another Harvard Business Review Press book. And this one, from the same publisher, is called Strategy That Works, How Winning Companies Close the Strategy to Execution Gap. And we're going to bring that to you right now. So, Paul, first of all, I want to thank you for joining us today. We're going to talk about your new book. It's called Strategy That Works, How Winning Companies Close the Strategy to Execution Gap. And you co-authored this with a colleague. Would you just give him a quick shout out?
Of course, Cesare Minardi and Art Kleiner.
Great. And you say that there's a huge business problem today, and that is that in many, many companies, in fact, in most companies, there's a gap between strategy and execution. And let's just look at some numbers there to put that in perspective for our listeners. I see here that 50% of senior executives don't think they have a winning strategy. That's not good. Two out of five are confident that they will realize their growth targets. Only two out of three admit they don't have the capabilities needed to create value. As many as 9 out of 10 concede that they're missing major opportunities in the market. And 4 out of 5 executives admit their overall strategy isn't well understood within their own company. So that, to me, is huge. What is going on?
Yeah, I mean, this is very concerning. You know, when we look at the economy in general and how companies are feeling about their future, I think it's important to note that we also live in a very difficult environment for most companies because we're facing competitors that we didn't know existed just a few years ago. You know, the digital world has opened up doors to small players that have come from nowhere, and frankly, also the digital world has made it very hard just to exist. You know, we get compared whether we're a B2C or a B2B business, a small company to a large company. There is no just surviving anymore. We have to bring unique advantages to the marketplace, and that's really what we learned in the 14 companies in the book, companies like Apple, Amazon, IKEA, Danaher, and others, that the way to win is through a unique identity, that we have to bring something very specific to the marketplace, and we have to be differentiated. Otherwise, we're just going to be like everyone else, and that's definitely not a good recipe for success.
Yeah, and, you know, I hear this all the time when I'm working with clients, you know, about, because I work a lot in communications consulting, and so, you know, trying to differentiate them, I find that many companies do not know how they're different. And that's as true for Fortune 50 companies sometimes as it is for a small mom and pop shop. So how do companies, you know, what are they doing to find out how they're different, to really get that narrowed down for themselves?
Well, you know, an identity can mean many things to many different companies and many executives, but for the 14 companies in the book, it's actually very specific and very tangible. Their identity is really two things. One, the promise that they make to their customers about what value they're going to create, and the few capabilities needed to deliver that promise. And let's just look at an example like IKEA. IKEA basically tells its customers, look, we're here to provide home furnishings and furniture that everybody can afford. That's the promise. You know, they saw this market that really wasn't affordable for many, and they said, we're going to change that. But IKEA also says, you know, we're not just going to make that promise, we're going to deliver it. They design furniture different than anyone else. They understand the cost and the prices of changing the furniture a little bit longer, using two colors versus four, using one type of wood versus another. They've got specific capabilities of how they transport the goods in flat boxes to save money. And they set up their stores in a different way than anyone else, opening their warehouses to consumers to essentially make us part of the process. And so a unique identity, again, is a promise you're making. It's your aspiration connected with your reality, those few capabilities that really help you set apart from anybody else.
Right. You talk about how the choices that those companies make to differentiate themselves, that they often run contrary to conventional wisdom of the industry. And you have a great, the whole book really is based around this premise of the five acts of unconventional management. I wonder if we can take a high level look at those. We talked a little bit about committing to an identity. With smaller companies, are there considerations that smaller business owners need to focus on versus larger, people who are working in larger corporations?
That's a great question. And in fact, the companies in the book, the 14, are sort of large global companies, but they weren't always that way. They most of them, started very small and actually grew through their capabilities.
Right.
They grew from the things that they did well. The five acts of unconventional leadership are important because, there's so much conventional wisdom out there for small companies, for medium-sized companies and large around what to do. And just one example of that is growth. Most companies are told, or they feel like the most important thing for them to do is search for growth. These companies say, growth should be the outcome of your advantage. It shouldn't be the strategy on its own. And they don't necessarily search for growth. What they're doing is they're improving their advantage, and then they're using that advantage to find ways to grow. It's much easier to grow from an advantage or from a growth engine, as we like to say, than merely searching for growth and then asking your company to somehow get there when it may not actually have the capabilities to succeed. The second act, which is all about building capabilities, here we find a lot of companies, again, big or small, trying to look to the market to sort of tell them what to do. I'm operating a business, I'm looking at, what someone else is doing, and I'm trying to copy where they are. Big companies look at benchmarks and best-in-class processes, and that can really lead to failure. You have to find the few things you need to do, given your identity, given the promise you're making. You have to build them, and you have to constantly improve them. Culture, the third act, is so incredibly important. Here we find that companies often are thinking about how to organize, how to assign responsibilities, how to think about incentives for their salespeople. And those are important topics, but these companies say more important is the culture. How to make sure you're finding the right behaviors, the positive behaviors that exist in your company already, and use those to actually execute the strategy, to remind all of the employees what's most important in this particular company. The fourth act was cost. Rather than waiting until you have a problem and taking out cost across the board, these companies are actually searching always for finding ways to take money out of one place and put it in another that's more important. And finally, the fifth act was shaping your future and not staring at disruption, being fearful, which is, I think, where a lot of companies are at right now, trying to figure out what's going to change, where disruption is going to come from, how technology will evolve. These companies are saying, we have to take control. We have to figure out where our customers are going. We have to disrupt ourselves and create new ways of demand, new ways of serving our customers so that we can actually get in front of them.
Right. So you were just talking about cutting costs, and with probably many people out there who've worked in the corporate world for a long time have been victims of downsizing. When companies look at cutting costs, they do tend to do it across the board, and you say that's the biggest mistake. And these companies who do really well don't do that at all. So I wonder if we could look at that in a little more detail.
No, absolutely. This is so important. And when we think about strategy and execution and the gap between those two, the part of the problem is these are topics that get managed very distinctly. Cost is a great example of that. I mean, the budgeting process is rarely connected to the most important things that the company does. The budgeting process typically is run by functions, run by business leaders, and, often reflects what last year was, maybe plus or minus a few percentage points. Cost is the most precious investment we have to create advantage in the marketplace. And when we see it that way, we make different choices. And these companies basically say, we're always looking to reallocate our cost. IKEA starts the year in the negative. They lower their prices not because they have to, not because they're not competitive, but because it forces them to relook at everything they're doing to find cost opportunities. Cemex, the cement company based out of Mexico, now operating in many parts of the world, during the housing crisis, when everybody was taking out costs, they were actually investing some of that cost back in to get to know local governments, because they knew that governments had a hard time getting infrastructure projects off the ground, and they were a commodity player and they wanted to differentiate themselves. And so all of the companies in our research really demonstrated that cost is not a negative topic, and we don't want to wait until we have a problem and downsize. That, at that point, we're sort of in trouble. We want to get in front of it. We want to constantly look at ways to reallocate the investment, not just take the investment away.
Right, right. And one of the things that I found really interesting is how you kind of assume that companies are shaping their own future, but so many really don't. You know, like people just managing their day-to-day careers, they react to what's happening around them. And so one of the things you say at the Act 5 is shaping your future. And these companies who are doing well do this extremely well. You say they seek out higher aspirations. They apply their capabilities to a broader range of challenges, to loftier goals. They serve the most fundamental needs and wants of their customers, which you'd think is a given, but is not done by all companies. And ultimately, that's how they become leaders in their own industry. So could we look at that a little more?
No, absolutely. And this is clearly so relevant today because so many executives and business owners are worried about what's coming down the pipeline and what change they're going to have to deal with. You know, I think the most important thing here that we learned from the research is that these companies do not define themselves by the products or services that go out the door. That sounds kind of simple, but if you really think about it, what they're doing is they're defining themselves by what they do, not what they sell. And companies that do that give themselves so many advantages, give them so many growth paths, because products and services will go. You know, they'll be relevant 1 minute, not relevant, you know, maybe the next year. But companies that actually think about their advantages, think about the things that they're doing, they can bring those to many places. The other important lesson about shaping the future is that these companies developed privileged access to their customers. And this allowed them to actually disrupt and create demand, create new products and services. So it was a capability to understand how their customers were living their lives. IKEA sending store managers into people's homes, or the Cemex example, where they get to know local officials so they understand the projects that local governments are thinking about way before the bid happens. So understanding the fundamental issues of our customers really allows us to design things around them. It's not about listening a little harder or doing more market research. It's actually about understanding what our customers are going through, whether that's a consumer or whether that's a B2B environment. It's really the same thing.
Yeah, I tell you, any company who understands their customer and treats them well has got my vote, because it's getting harder and harder to find that level of service now.
Well, and think about the trust that we put behind some of these companies. So, you know, Apple, when we go to the Genius Bar and we bring them our electronic devices, you know, we're not just sort of going there and saying, teach me a few things. We're actually sometimes talking about the fundamental issues we have with our life and how that translates in the digital world. And that's a vehicle for them to learn about what we're doing. Apple will always say, well, we don't really, you know, respond to what people want. But what they are doing is they're trying to figure out those very basic issues. And they have a capability, their Genius Bar, which frankly is much better than a market research survey. They can actually see it themselves. That's so incredibly helpful.
Right, right. Well, going back to the statistics we talked about in the beginning and how, you know, so many leaders, business leaders, are not happy with the gap and between strategy and execution, and feel that they're missing major opportunities, and they're not, if they're missing major opportunities, they're not also providing the services that people probably want and need. Is the problem, does the problem start in business schools? I know you teach, I know you're an adjunct professor, and I read that a student, I don't know if this was in your class, I think it was where you were presenting, said that most of our professors are telling us to do these things the old way. And you say the five acts of unconventional leadership contradict what many believe is the right way to run a business. So I'm assuming you're teaching this, but many students are not being taught that.
You know, this goes to a pretty fundamental issue that we have in business today, which is we basically are living in a functional world. And that's true in business, that's true in business schools. you know, where we specialize. And there's great things to specialization, but in today's world, you know, those functional boundaries don't really help us that much. You know, the great solutions to innovation don't just sit in R&D. They sit across marketing and insights and supply chain. And companies are recognizing this, and they're really spanning boundaries when they're building some of these great capabilities. And I think business schools need to do the same thing. And I think business schools do recognize that a lot of the great research they do, and there is great research, sometimes sits within some silos. But I think some examples of what business schools are doing is they're getting beyond that, and they're starting to deal with some of these very big issues. And frankly, we need them to do that. There are a lot of issues out there in the world that won't get solved sitting inside of some of the functional boundaries that we have.
Mm. You say the five acts are so interconnected that we have to adopt them all together. If we overlook any one of them, we'll fall back. And you give an example of if you don't commit to identity, we risk becoming scattered. What other risks do we take there if we don't adopt them all together?
Well, you know, what happens inside of most companies is we actually have many things operating separately. You think about the budgeting process and the strategy process, the growth process, the portfolio process, the human talent process. We have lots of things happening in a company that should be coherent. They should be working together against that clear identity. And as you point out, you know, if we don't know the things that we have to be great at, if we don't know the promise we're making to customers, it's going to be pretty tough for our employees to come to work every day and understand what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And human beings, we don't connect as well with products. You know, there was someone that invented that great product, and there's a few people that engineered it, but human beings do connect with capabilities. If we say that we're about design, it's much easier for many employees to understand what role they play. And great companies articulate 3, 4, 5 amazing capabilities that really drive their success. And so I think it is incredibly important for companies to be clear about that identity. Without that solved, the other things become very difficult. And I think it's true of all five acts. If I don't put cost in the right place, then I can have a great identity, but I don't deliver it by fueling the investments to the right place. If I don't have the right culture, if I'm not enabling people to work together, I'm not going to build these incredible capabilities because people will be sitting in functions. Culture is actually what allows people to get beyond their boundaries and build the incredible. If I'm not shaping my future, if I'm not thinking about how my identity will have to change, if I'm not thinking about listening to my customers but doing better than listening, really understanding them, I'll get stuck. And so really, this is a way of operating your company with these five unconventional acts. And the good news here is that we have these 14 companies which really exhibit these five acts working together. And it's really been quite a story in terms of understanding how they've done that.
Right. And what happens, I've seen many companies where the culture is very mixed. You go to one group and the culture is this way, and another group has almost an entirely different culture. How does one make a culture cohesive?
This is such a great question, and I think people struggle with culture because it feels like an amorphous kind of soft topic. You know, but in the book, what we found is that these companies use culture very tangibly. And you're right that in a company, you will have many cultural behaviors. And I think one of the instincts that we often have is to fight the negative behaviors and to change them. Well, the challenge is that culture fights back pretty aggressively. These companies, what they did is they said they looked for small behaviors that really changed the execution of the company. And they focused in on that. You know, a great example from the book is the company Natura, based out of Brazil,
yes.
A very successful cosmetics company. They essentially go door to door with 1.5 million sales consultants that are selling their line of personal care products. And what they recognize is the success of that model was all the stories these people were telling going door to door. It was relationship building. And when they realized this, the company basically said, this is a cultural behavior we have to reinforce. And so when the management team approves a new plan, they're asking questions like, who are the people being employed? Are we actually going to, you know, put this in the right location to serve the environment around it and the community around it? Will we hire underprivileged workers? If we procure a new ingredient from the rainforest, what happens to those farmers? What happens to the environment? Now, they're not just doing that because it's the right thing to do, although it is. They're doing it because that feeds the stories. It reminds everyone that relationships are important. And without relationships, the company would not be successful. So where we see culture working, it's finding those few behaviors that support the strategy, that remind people how to execute, and really makes the entire company work together against that goal.
Right. And I know I have to let you go, Paul, but I'd like to just ask you one more question here about how do you know when it's time to switch strategy? How do you know when it's time to call it a day versus hanging in there to just give it a little bit longer to see if it's going to work?
Yeah, I mean, as you probably opened with, we have 50% of senior executives saying they don't have a winning strategy. And I think because of that, we do have to ask ourselves, is it because the strategy itself was not designed to be executable? That's definitely a big issue. Or is it because we haven't actually focused on how to execute it? I think in many cases, strategies do need to be revisited. And I think the best companies actually update their strategies all the time rather than waiting, every 3 to 5 years to really take a look. They're constantly thinking about how to evolve around their identity, not a wholesale new change. But there are companies that their strategies are probably in great shape. The issue is they haven't spent the time to really think about the rest of those unconventional acts and how they can execute better.
Right. Well, I really enjoyed talking with you. It's a great book, Strategy That Works, How Winning Companies Close the Strategy to Execution Gap. And a final quick thought you'd like to leave our listeners with, Paul.
We answer these fundamental questions, and leaders, there's a great opportunity for them to really get after, what is the company all about? What are the things that we have to be better at than anyone else? These sound like simple questions, but answering them is not so easy, and many executives could benefit greatly from having a clear answer for their entire organization.
Great. Paul Leinwand, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Vicki.
And my guest there, Paul Leinwand. And you can find out more about Paul and the work that he does with strategy and at pwc.com. He's also an adjunct professor at Kellogg. And so you can find him at kellogg.northwestern.edu. And also at strategy-business.com. That's where you'll find out more about the book and articles that complement it. So we're going to change gears now. We're going to take a little road trip vicariously. Okay, we're going to do it vicariously, but I'll take vicariously today. Stay with us. We'll be right back with 125 wacky roadside attractions. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
It looks like a road that you travel on when there's one day and the next day gone. Sometimes you bend, sometimes you stand, sometimes you turn your back to the wind. There's a world outside the dark and dark.
Coming July 25th on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, The Whole Detox with Dr. Deanna Minich. She says it's not enough to just detox the body. You have to detox every area of your life for complete holistic health. This 21-day program will help you do that. We'll also hear from Dr. Craig Malkin, whose book, Rethinking Narcissism, helps you recognize and get rid of the narcissists who've infiltrated your life. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific time here on Alternative Talk 1150 and find more than 400 podcasts at conversationslive.net.
Looking for unconditional love, an exercise buddy, or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967 because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing. Writing it, another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you at the exact level you need. Whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. email Vicki@VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. Well, that's the kind of music I was playing in May when I took my 1,200-mile trip, my solo trip. I loved it. So thanks, Eric. Thanks for that. It just brought all those memories back to me. We are talking right now. We're going to bring you a conversation I had with Kitson Jasinka. And she is a kids author. She writes books and articles for National Geographic Kids. And as I said at the top of the hour, don't think these books are just for kids, because let me tell you, I spent a very happy hour browsing through that book myself. And it has some really neat attractions there. So if you're planning a trip or you don't know where to go, pick up a copy. Whether you've got kids or not, there's something in there that, just about everybody will find interesting. And let me tell you a little bit about her, and then we'll bring on the conversation that we had. And not surprisingly, she loves to travel. She usually travels with her family. She's been pretty much all over the place, and usually takes a dog or two as well, she said. And they've literally made thousands and thousands of miles worth of trips around the U.S. They've cruised around the Grand Canyon, up and down the East Coast, from Florida to Maine and back again. And some of her favorite stops, she said, are Ben & Jerry's Ice Cream Flavor Graveyard in Waterbury, Vermont, and the Museum of Bad Art in Somerville, Massachusetts. She is, as I said, a writer for National Geographic and has written many, many books. This new book is called National Geographic Kids, 125 Roadside Attractions, See All the Weird, Wonderful, and Downright Bizarre Landmarks from Around the World. And it really is full of just the silly, the weird, the macabre, the spooky, and the beautiful. There were a couple of things in there that were just stunningly beautiful. So let me bring that conversation to you right now. So we're talking today about this new book from National Geographic Kids. It's all about the silly, the weird, the macabre, the spooky. As you're traveling around, there are all these unique places, unique lodgings, unique sights to see. Tell us a little bit about the book in your own words, Kitson.
Hi. So National Geographic Kids is all about teaching the kids about the world in a very fun and colorful, vivid way. And so to me, this book sort of embodies that. Whether you're actually out on a road trip to some of these really amazing places, or if you're just in the back, the kids are in the back of the car, this is a great book to, kind of take an adventure, even if it's just in your own mind. I have two kids, two boys that are 9 and 12, and they're not great readers, but they love tearing into this book because it's just kind of a great. They just have, there's tons of stuff to talk about and look at and debate and giggle over.
Yeah, and I've said this before, but I am addicted to these kids' books because they're so interesting. I mean, there's things in there that you just would never find, they wouldn't jump out at you on the internet for sure. I'm wondering, when you put a book together like this, because you cover different places around the world, including the United States, how does this how does this come together in the beginning? Who comes up with the idea? Hey, let's create this book about all these wacky places we can see on road trips.
So the book itself is part of a series that National Geographic Kids has done called 120. The series is the 125 series, and they're all the same type of thing where they take a topic and then explore 125 of that topic. And so other ones in the series, there's one that I did called 125 Cute Animals, one called 125 True Stories of Amazing Animals. There's one about amazing pets. There's one about cool inventions. There's another one that I did that's coming out either at the end of this year or the beginning of next year about 125 rescued pets. So that's the setup for where this book fits in to that series. The topics, there was a writer, there's another writer on the West Coast that I collaborated with. I live in Washington, D.C., and so we put our heads together. We both talked to lots of people, friends, family, word on the street about, you know, amazing roadside attractions. And then we had sort of a monster list of ideas. And then it's narrowed down based on what we think is the most interesting. There's some, you know, sort of balance of geography. And then, of course, because, like, pretty much everything at National Geographic, it has so much to do with the images that, you know, photography is a big part of the equation, too. So, and that's pretty much it. Once we had our list narrowed down, we went to work doing research and talking to people. We also worked with a National Geographic Young Explorer. Now, that's she's a grantee of National Geographic, and her area of expertise in terms of exploration is road trips. So she was a very interesting resource. There's an interview with her at the end of the book. So she had some great insights and ideas and lots to talk about with her.
Right, right. So let's look at some of these things. And since we're broadcasting from Seattle, Washington, let's look at two of our places. My brother, when he came out here from England, was enthralled with the troll under the bridge. We actually missed the gum wall that you mentioned in the book because I didn't know it existed until after he'd gone home. But talk to us a little bit about why you included these two items in here.
You know, to me, these kind of places sort of embody the spirit of the whole book. You know, I grew up reading National Geographic kids' books and the magazine, and I never really outgrew the tendency to want to stop and linger and admire things that were, like, weird, wacky, funny, cute, amazing, sometimes a little creepy, whatever. I love that part where you're really just trying to figure out what somebody was trying to do here. And these kind of places, I think, sort of embody that spirit. Like, it's not the best art, you know, but it's an amazing either sort of cultural phenomenon or an amazing piece of art, the troll under the bridge, in a way that kind of just makes you want to stop and linger a little bit and figure out what this is and why it happened. The gum wall, I have to tell you, is one of my kids' favorite in the entire book. Not only have they charted out an entire Pacific Northwest trip, you know, with this as, like, their anchor attraction, the gum wall, but my son, who's in fourth grade, he actually this month is working on a project in school about Washington State. And I actually, when I was preparing for the interview, I had to go and find another copy of the book that had this page in it because I found he had ripped the page out using his project.
Oh, that's funny. I see here also
Washington State.
That's so funny. So I see also there's a bubblegum alley in San Luis Obispo, too, which I've been to many times in California, and I didn't know that was there either. But one of the things that really intrigued me was some of the unique lodging that you found, because I think especially when you are traveling with kids, that really adds an element to the trip. And a couple of the places, and I'll just mention them and then you can talk about them, but there was a volcano inspired in Chile, which looked great to me. There's an upside-down house in Poland, a beagle-shaped guest house in Cottonwood, Idaho, Igloo Hotel in Finland. Tell us a little bit about what was your favorite lodging?
Yeah, I have to say, I've got a few. The Giraffe Manor in Kenya, where you can go and interact with the resident giraffe. This place is like my dream come true. I'm a animal lover.
Right.
And I've actually been to South Africa many times, but I've never stayed in a place where you could be so up close and personal with a giraffe. And, I mean, this place, basically, it's like they've built the windows in such a way that the giraffes are encouraged to kind of dip in and, you know, enjoy a little bit of breakfast. You can see the picture. That one's on page 19. Another one that I really like is the car motel, something that my kids could really get into. It's right off the Audubon, and the rooms are all sort of wildly decked out, based on cars. There's another one. I don't think it's a place you can stay anymore, but it once was in New Jersey on page 29, Lucy the Elephant. This is this historic building that is shaped like a massive elephant
right
on the Jersey Shore. Her name is Lucy. I mean, she's taller than a six-story building, and she's been around since 1881. And at times she's been like a tavern with rooms of each house. And there's legs that go up the spiral there's spiral staircases within her legs. That's how you get up there.
That's amazing.
I agree.
Yeah, that's really amazing. I also loved, when you're talking about Giraffe Manor, there was a picture next to that of the Cave Hotel, too. The hotel built into the cave. That looked really awesome, too. Some amazing things. One of my favorite things as a child, we would go sometimes on a Sunday run and we'd go to this pub called the Crooked House. And when you walked in there, it was an optical illusion, but you felt as though you'd just come off a roundabout spinning around. It would make you a little dizzy. You would sit at a table and you could lay a bottle on its side and it would seemingly roll uphill up the table.
Oh, wow.
So I think, you know, children really appreciate those kind of things. They're just novel and different.
Absolutely.
So a couple of the other things you talk about, and is that there's 125 sites to see here, experiences to have. A couple of the other things you talk about, one of the other things is check the calendar to see what kind of events are around. You talk about the European Beard Championships, the outhouse race in Anchorage. Do you have a favorite one there?
You know, there's another sort of seasonal one that is kind of fun. On page 62, the corn maze in New Jersey. You know, corn mazes, there are a lot of them around, but this one I think would really be worth making a trip to because it's a 10-acre corn maze. So, and they come up with these extreme themes, and, you know, you can do it at night, so it's kind of... It's an amazing sort of seasonal fun thing.
Right.
And also, I think in Wisconsin, the National Mustard Museum, they also have some great events at that place.
Mm. So one of the things that really appealed to me, I wrote it down in my notebook so I don't forget, is on page 73 you talk about the ice-covered lighthouse in St. Joseph, mm-hmm. Michigan. That did not look real. It looked like a candle made of wax. But apparently when the waves slapped up the side of the lighthouse, they all froze and created this just beautiful, stunning image.
I agree. It doesn't look real. It's really amazing.
And so when you are traveling with your kids, because I know you travel with them a lot, you have some photos of you on the website, and one of the places you like is Africa. But you mentioned that. But apart from Africa, where else, what's another favorite spot for you as a family?
You know, we had a great trip last year to Puerto Rico on an island off the east coast of Puerto Rico, where we did a lot of traveling around. Because of where our family lives, I end up doing a lot of, like, D.C. to Maine and or D.C. to Florida. And some on some unfortunate times, I've even done Florida to D.C. to Maine. So we kind of, a lot of years, we sort of stick to the East Coast.
Mm-hmm.
But I also do a lot of writing for National Geographic about wildlife. So one of the fun things for me with my kids on our summer trips has been to stop at some of the wildlife rescues, for instance, people that I might meet during the year while, you know, maybe I'll just do a phone interview. For instance, last year, the year before, on our way to Cape Cod, I figured out a way to not go too much of a detour, but to stop at the Wolf Conservation Center in Southdale, New York. And it was just such a phenomenal place to stop. Of course, I had met the people, so they gave us a really nice tour. But to meet these wolves in person, and, you know, by the time we left, it was kind of a cool, you know, summer day, and it was starting to drizzle, and we stood there at the bottom of the driveway, and we all howled, and the wolves howled back, and, you know, it was just an incredible experience.
Yes, I can imagine. Well, Kitsunjit Zinkari, thank you for being with us today. What's the final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with about this amazing 125 roadside attractions book?
You know, I think the one thought that I'd like to leave people with is just, you know, it's just the suggestion to just indulge in lingering over these things. I think we're always in such a rush in our kind of modern day life that if you're going on a trip, maybe, you know, budget in a few extra hours every day so you can stop and just kind of linger and enjoy and giggle and chat and, you know, make some great memories along the way.
Thanks. And even if you can't take that trip, the book is worth reading. You can be an armchair tourist. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And if you want to learn more about Kitsun Jasinka and the work she's doing, you can find her at her website. I'll spell it out for you. It's K-I-T-S-O-N, Kitsun, and Jasinka is J-A-Z-Y-N-K-A. So J-A-Z-Y-N-K-A, kitsunjasinka.com. And you can find the book, of course, at nationalgeographic.com and in bookstores. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
When I was little, I didn't talk for a long time. I was sensitive to lights and sounds, so I'd build secret hiding places where they couldn't get in. Sometimes, I'd do the same things over and over, until one day, I found out I had autism. My family got me help. Slowly, I learned how to live with it better.
Early intervention can make a lifetime of difference. Learn the signs at autismspeaks.org/signs. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Did you know that capsizing boats and people falling overboard account for over 70% of boating fatalities? 80% of those fatalities occur on boats under 26 feet and on boats with operators who've had no formal boating instruction. 50% of all boating accidents involve alcohol. Be smart this summer. Know who you're boating with. Wear a Coast Guard approved life jacket and don't drink and boat. This message is brought to you by supporters of Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair and the JMB Group, who wish you safe boating fun.
Coming July 25th on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, the whole detox with Dr. Deanna Minich. She says it's not enough to just detox the body. You have to detox every area of your life for complete holistic health. This 21-day program will help you do that. We'll also hear from Dr. Craig Malkin, whose book, Rethinking Narcissism, helps you recognize and get rid of the narcissists who've infiltrated your life. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific time here on Alternative Talk 1150 and find more than 400 podcasts at conversationslive.net.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Multicultural, multidimensional even. Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. Well, we, of course, just talked with Kitson Jasinka about National Geographic's new book, the one that she wrote called 125 Wacky Roadside Attractions. And I just wanted to point out that that book does, it goes international. It covers items from Japan to New Zealand to southern Chile, central Alaska, etc. A lot of stuff in there. Well, we have a couple of minutes at the end of today's show, and I thought I'd share one of my favorite attractions. I don't know if you call it attraction, but it's a different kind of hotel. It's not really suitable for kids, though. I have to say that up front. And they don't allow pets, but it's a really unique kind of hotel. I've stayed in it several times on my way up and down the coast. It's down in Oregon. It's called the Sylvia Beach Hotel. And each room there is named and decorated after a famous author. So you've got the Agatha Christie room. I've stayed in that a couple of times. You've got Tolkien, Oscar Wilde, Gertrude Stein, Shakespeare. I just saw they have a new one. I don't know if it's new, but it wasn't there last time I was there. It's called the J.K. Rowling room. And it's done out with, I see the owl is in there from Hogwarts. So I think I'm going to have to stay in that room next time I go down there. But what makes it really unique, I may be speaking out of turn here, but there used to be no telephones in there and no televisions whatsoever. And there's no elevator, so you have to walk up the stairs. Not a big deal. And they have a communal room, a loft, and a balcony below that looks over the ocean. It's right on the beach. So it's right on Newport Beach, looking over the ocean. And it is stuffed full of books. It's also stuffed full of journals that visitors just go and they just start journaling. And some people do pages and pages and pages of journaling. And just leave it there and you can read it. Not only are you taking a vicarious trip, you're doing a little voyeurism there. But it's just a really neat place. And the dining is really good. They serve fresh local fare. They serve it family style. So you may sit with other people at your table. It's very relaxed. Every time I've gone there, I have to say I come back and I feel like I've really taken a break. Especially being right there on the beach where you can go down and walk. So that's one of my favorite places. And, you know, I just took a 1,200-mile road trip myself. I try and do that at least once a year by myself so I can just kind of regroup and think about things. And so I took a week-long road trip this time and went down to – I actually went to a conference in Walla Walla and then down to – I took off from there. And it was really fun. So I thought I'd just ask Eric if you've got any favorite road trips, spots that you like.
Yes, absolutely. And, I enjoyed this interview very much, and I'm going to have to check out this book on the roadside attractions because I find all that stuff fascinating, even if I don't get a chance to go.
Even if you don't go.
Visit them, yeah. But if you are looking for a short road trip here in the Great Northwest, it popped down to Tacoma where the Bob's Java Jive is on South Tacoma Way, and it is a building that is shaped like a giant coffee pot, but inside is a bar, and they do shows. My band has played there a few times, and they've had legendary musicians through the years have played there and come through there, like The Ventures and many other people. River Phoenix was there when he was in town shooting a movie. And so a very cool place to check out and check off your list of the cool, wacky roadside attractions to see.
It's quite surprising when you start looking. One of the things as well you just mentioned was a squirrel bridge down in...
I found a great website that talks about some of these wacky roadside attractions. And one that I'm definitely going to have to check out is in Longview, Washington. It's called the Nutty Narrow Squirrel Bridge. And they have a street that is pretty busy, and unfortunately, squirrels were getting creamed on a regular basis. So one guy decided, I'm going to build a bridge for them so they can get across the street without harm to them. And so they built this great bridge, and it looks kind of like the Narrows Bridge in Tacoma, but it's just for squirrels. And so I'll definitely check that out on my next time through Longview.
I love it. I wonder how he trained them. He must have left a trail of nuts across that.
Maybe. Squirrels are pretty wily.
They are.
They probably just figured it out.
Well, thanks for sharing that, Eric. That was fun. All right. So that brings us right to the end of today's show. So if you have feedback, questions, or comments, you know where to reach me. You can reach me at info@conversationslive.net. You can reach me on the 800 number at 495-7617, 800-495-7617. You can also find me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair and on Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And we always love to hear from you. And, you know, if you have suggestions for future shows or would like to know more about certain travel places, I'm always happy to explore them and see if we can do a segment on those. It's always fun. So anyway, thanks for joining us today. We will be back next week with a live show, and we look forward to having you join us then. Until then, live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.